FM4
Filmpodcast.
I am a believer in Joy Division. Hallelujah.
Now remember, we are live, so no swearing or they will cut you off.
What about Big Dog's cock? Can you say that?
You can't stay here. I've made arrangements for you to leave town while I sort this out.
You can't do this. I'm a lawyer.
Lawyer? I'm a social worker for terrorists. You've crossed the line. You're on their side now.
There's this kid, and he's interesting.
There's an awkwardness, something very pure. You can't fake it.
The kid's name's James Dean.
Existence. Well, what does it matter?
Hypnosis created the most important artwork in the world.
I exist on the best terms I can. The past is now part of my future.
I think I'll have to talk to someone about that. Reach out
and touch faith. Herzlich willkommen zum FM4 Film Podcast, sagt Christian Fuchs. Und wir sind jetzt nicht im FM4 Studio, wie gewohnt, sondern wir sind in den Räumlichkeiten des Kunstforums Wien. Herzlichen Dank an dieser Stelle. Und ich sitze unserem Gast gegenüber. A very warm welcome to Mr. Anton Korbein.
Yes, thank you very much.
You're an iconic photographer. You did legendary music videos. You have been art director for a few bands. You did a lot of stuff for Depeche Mode. Still today, you did a lot of stuff for U2. Record covers and pictures and music videos. But you also did 4 feature films. You did Control in 2007. You did The American in 2010. A Most Wanted Man, 2014. Life, 2015. And a documentary, Squaring the Circle, 2023, about designer team Hypnosis. Let's dive deep into the beginning, maybe. What was your first cinematic experience or a film you can remember, maybe as a child? I've read you have a Protestant childhood, so maybe you saw films later in life, but what made a big impression of you cinematic?
Well, we in Holland, I grew up on a village on an island, so the access to cinemas was negligent. So we had a TV, black and white, and we had 2 channels. And of course, proper serious films I never got to see. On TV, we saw American series like Rawhide, which I loved, which is a Western, with Gil Favor and Clint Eastwood. And I loved that. So that's why I think I like Westerns, because I grew up with watching that on TV on a Saturday afternoon. And there was a lot of slapstick as well, Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, all these people were in a program called Comedy Capers, and Lauren Hardy. So I loved all that. Then the first time I went to cinema was when we moved away from the island. When I was 11, my family moved to the middle of Holland. And then I think I was 14 or 15, my parents took me to see The Sound of Music, which was a safe bet, I guess. And that was fantastic to see a big screen.
Having a childhood without many moving images around, without images in general, many around, did this make you more sensible in a way or more serious when you talk or when you work with visuals?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know what the effect of it is, you know. I grew up in a very serious childhood, so everything I did, I think I felt was serious. So my photography, I took very serious. And later, when I tried to do less serious pictures, it was very hard to actually get results that were not serious, because they were still good results, and had a layer of meaningfulness to it. So I know. I think you're so formed by where you grew up and the cultural impact of seeing things for the first time. Like, I went once to a museum before I was 18, only once. And it was with my father when he took me to a Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. There's an exhibition of Rembrandt, but it was the religious paintings from Rembrandt. And of course, my father was the minister of religion. He had no idea about art, but he understood the religious meaning of these paintings. It's the only reason we went to see him, was they were religious paintings.
You went to London in the late 70s and worked for papers like the New Music Express, did photographs of lots of musicians of the time, like from the post-punk scene and from the pop scene. When was the point in your life when you thought, okay, maybe I want to take a step in the direction of moving images or even making films? Was it through music videos?
Well, it was for me already a big step to make music videos from a stills perspective to movie things. But I started that early 80s, so I was one of the earlier music video makers. And then, funny enough, I worked with two German bands for my first videos. One was Palais Chambourg and one was Propaganda. Propaganda, of course, was produced by Trevor Horn, who was in London for ZTT Records. And I did a lot of stuff for ZTT with Frankie Goes to Hollywood and Out of Noise and whatever. But it was not till, I guess, 20 years later that people started to say you should be making films, you know, because your videos are always stories. And I was shy and I could not see myself making a film because I had no idea how you made a film. I was not technical. I was not informed enough to be making a film. So I always said no. They sent me scripts and I said no. It was not me pushing for it. They were pushing for it. But it was when the story of Ian Curtis came around that I thought, oh, maybe if I ever make a film, this might be it, because I knew Ian Curtis. He was one of the reasons why I moved to England, at least his music was. He was in a band called Joy Division. And anyway, I decided to make that film, and that won major prizes in England, at least. So then I got offered other films, and suddenly I was a film director. But I had not seen that coming, you know.
You said your music videos have always been around stories. When I think of your videos, they're also quite abstract sometimes and they leave a lot of room for imagination, because often music videos are little films, like with a structure, like a film that's sometimes boring because with an ending and everything, but there's much more room for imagination. How was the step from like a script and a filmic structure with the music videos before?
Music videos are, of course, a very different kettle of fish than films and movies. But the great thing is when you make music videos, you understand about movement and maybe about light and all these things. So you get more easier with the equipment that's being used and you feel more at home, I guess, in that world. And at least that worked for me. My first movie is Control. The camera hardly ever moved, you know. So it was very much like stills. And now I'm more confident and the camera moves a lot more. So that was a process for me. You know, I'm not a natural filmmaker. I know very few movies, actually. So I don't remember much. It's another, I'm a dreamer.
Control is also in black and white. And yes, it reminds one of a lot of your pictures as well. So the aesthetic was a little bit orientated on the time, where during the time when you made the pictures of Joy Division and bands like this, was this an influence, your own photography on this film?
Well, when I thought of Joy Division, because I met them in November 79, you know, England was a very poor country. There's two reasons. One was that I quite often went for the music magazines to Manchester or Birmingham, all these countries, but you go by other cities, you go by train, and then you see always the back of the houses, you know, when you're on the train. And it's so poor compared to where I came from Holland. It was so poor. So it always reminded me of the Joy Division time, how poor England was. And then in the days that I took pictures of Joy Division, of course, you shot on film. There was no digital world. And the only people that were interested in Joy Division were independent magazines, and they were always printed in black and white. It's only when people had hits, then they moved on to the magazines that were printed in color. It's as simple as that. If you look for pictures of Joy Division in color, I think you don't see many because people couldn't sell those, you know, because nobody who printed color was interested in Joy Division at the time. It wasn't until Ian committed suicide and the song that came out the next week, which was Love Will Tear Us Apart, was the first hit. And then people would have wanted to take pictures in color.
two great things for me about the film Control. One thing is you show how normal these guys are. They are not like rock stars like the early Rolling Stones or compared to other post-punk bands. You show a very normal side of this band. And yeah, you show just a short period in the life of Ian Curtis. You don't show his childhood. Are you bored of normal biopics, like showing the whole life of someone? You want to show just a certain glimpse? How important was it for you to portray this disguise or Ian as yeah, normal, like from the neighborhood?
I want to be as realistic as possible. And, you know, all these biopics where people get their shoes shined and there's a song in there, you know. I hate that because it doesn't work like that. You know, things move slowly and simply, you know, and they're in people's heads. They're not major events where music comes out of, I think. So I guess looking back at the Control is very realistic and therefore speaks to a lot of people. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of music biopics now, but they don't oversell the truth, and they're very much hyped, I think, in way they get shot and the events that happen. You know, Freddie Mercury didn't know he had AIDS when he played Live Aid, you know. I mean, they just move things around for cinematic reasons, but that becomes, for a lot of people, that becomes the reality. They think what the film says is real. I don't know, I think there's a bit of responsibility for filmmakers there.
I imagine in your case that photography is kind of a quiet profession. I can't imagine you like being a flashy photographer, this and that and this and that. But when you did the concert scenes for Control, how was that compared to your job as a photographer to make these big concert scenes?
But they were not that big. But, you know, that's when I realized when you make movies, you have a whole team with you that organize things for you, you know. They know how to get crowds look realistic and all that. Then also the actors we had, they loved playing these musicians, and they learned instruments for the movie. So everybody was invested emotionally and otherwise into making this look realistic.
You started the career of Sam Riley.
Absolutely, and he started mine. But yeah, that was a gift. God given gift, I think, with Sam. He was marvelous in the film. And we sort of realized for both of it was an important film.
You mentioned the teamwork. I mean, maybe you have assistants when you work as a photographer, but films, there is such a big crew. How is it for you to work within these crews or the teamwork?
That was a bit of a change because up till then I photographed mostly on my own. No, not much assistance. I think since 1990 I had an assistant now and then on the bigger shoots. But there's a lot of shoots I do on my own. So to go from that to a movie was a big change in terms of being surrounded by so many people and having to think of so many things and people wanting answers all the time. But once you get beyond that, I think it's really beautiful that you all together work on something and make that happen. And with Control, it really felt like that. Because we're all in this village in England and in Nottingham or in Macclesfield. And we all wanted to make this movie, and it was a beautiful summer. I had imagined it'd be really cloudy, dark kind of atmosphere. And then suddenly, that summer we were shooting the film, there was so much sun. And we have very little real outdoor shots in the film. But there's somewhere where Ian Curtis and his girlfriend, Deborah, are sitting outside or running through the fields. And it's really nice that actually it's nice weather for these scenes because you need that light in the film, I think.
Your second film, The American, with George Clooney as an ex-hitman who wants to resign and goes to a little village in Italy. I think one thing it has in common with Control is the melancholy. There is a certain kind of melancholy through the whole film. It's a thriller, but it's not an action-loaded thriller. How did the idea for this film come up?
It's based on an English book called The Private A Very Private Gentleman, I think it's called. And it's fictional. You know, after Control, I called, offered all these movies that deal with musicians who died young, you know, whether it's Kurt Cobain or Jeff Buckley or Marvin Gaye or whatever. That's what they came with to me. And I thought, oh, this is really not the way I want to go on. If I, Control is such a great experience, but I don't want to become the guy that does biopics of musicians who pass away. So I tried to do something that's quite different. And I thought that at least it needs to be fictional. And also I wanted it to be, have American actors in it. So just to get a different experience. You know? And I wanted it to be in color. And so somebody wrote the screenplay based on that book. And that was set in Abruzzo. And then I made a little bit more like a Western because I wanted to make a Western. So I saw there's like, you know, a hitman tries to hide himself. He goes to villages and he becomes friends with the priest and the prostitute. And then his past catches up with him and he has to run away again to another village. That's how I looked at it. And I wanted to call it Il Americano, which is incorrect Italian for the American, but I wanted to show that he didn't fit. You know, there was an American. He tried to be Italian, but he couldn't. He was an American. But it was my first studio film, so they wouldn't allow it. So, you know, that's how you work in that system, I guess. I don't know about melancholy. I think it's a study in a way, I think, of somebody in that position.
Maybe laconic is another word. You mentioned Westerns. When I think about, I thought also as a child, I saw this face of Clint Eastwood on the TV screen a lot of times. In my case, I think it had a bad influence in a way because for many, many years, I thought a man has to be like Clint Eastwood, like staring like this lonely. And he influenced maybe whole generations in a wrong direction, if I can say this. Even if it's an amazing act and those films are iconic. But I can see a little bit of that influence in George Clooney's character, how he acts.
Yeah, perhaps, yeah. I mean, I wanted it to be like that, and I asked him to do chewing gum instead of chewing on tobacco. You know, so that came from Westerns.
And your next film, A Most Wanted Man, 2014, is... Because you said the American is maybe some kind of Western. Most Wanted Man is some kind of spy picture, but without anything those spy pictures have today, like Tom Cruise running for 40 minutes somewhere. It's based on a book by John Le Carré.
Yeah. I can't see Philip running for 40 minutes. But no, it's not that. It's old-fashioned, you know, where people sit in cars and look at things, you know, and report on that. And it's old-fashioned and it's, you know, the main detective has seen better days, you know, but he still believes in an honest society. But he's been beaten up by the society quite a lot of times, so he's bitter in a way. But yeah, that was a great film to make for me because I loved Philip. It was unfortunate, it was his last movie. And I was so grateful he was open to that. Yeah.
The late, great Philip Seymour Hoffman, you did also an amazing picture of him as a photographer. Was that around the time of the movie?
Well, I did a few pictures with him. I met him on a Vogue shoot. So that the picture, for instance, on the cover of the book here in the museum, that was for Vogue. So it was prior to the film. But it was the first time I met him, and then we had lunch together and talked about him being in the film. So.
Because we're also such big fans of him here in the film podcast. Do you have a story maybe of working with him together, how he was on set?
Well, you know, you always hear that actors are really vain, you know, they want to look good, you know, which is very boring, of course. Philip didn't have that. Philip had no vanity for himself. He was interested in the vanity of the person he portrayed. He never looked on the playback to see how he looked. The only time that he went to the playback was to see how he sounded, because he had to have some German accent in it. So he always wanted to hear back, but didn't look back. So that's so great to see that somebody's gave everything to play that character, including his own vanity. He just left it at the door.
You have an amazing cast in this film, not only Philip Seymour Hoffman. It's Rachel McAdams, Willem Dafoe, Robin Wright, Daniel Brühl, Nina Hoss. How was it to work with this cast of people?
Great. I mean, some great German actors and great American actors. And Willem I knew, and still friends. I love Willem's acting, and he's done so many different roles, over 100. Nina was a friend of mine. She actually married to another friend of mine. So that felt great to be working with her. I had actually wanted to use her in The American, but the studio wanted somebody else. But she's superb actors, and Philip thought so too. Then Daniel Brühl, really good. And he, of course, has gone on to do other things. He did also the movie with the racing car. Rush, is it Rush?
Yeah, he played Niki Lauda, an Austrian, famous Austrian driver.
Yeah. I mean, I was asked to do the film, but I didn't have enough affinity with racing to say yes to that. And then Rachel McAdams, yeah, also, she was a good actress, a very likable actress as well.
You said you had no affinity, maybe. Your films are art projects that have to respond with something within you. You would never do a picture like, I don't know, for a big studio, this and this script, like an action movie or something like this.
Well, I never say never. For instance, Harrison Ford really wanted to work with me, which I'm surprised, but he loved the Most Wanted Man film. And so I went for a talk with the producers for Blade Runner 2. But, you know, it's so not my world. And then you have to talk yourself up in a meeting with these producers that you are the guy who could make this film. It's just not my my mindset, you know. So obviously I didn't get it. But it's great. I think Most Wanted Men, that really, also Dustin Hoffman wrote to me. That's a movie that really, a lot of actors responded very positive to that film. Yeah.
What's the biggest difference between photography and films in a way?
Scale. You know, photography I can do on my own. Film, I need 150 people around me, I guess. Money, you know, the budget for a photograph, for what I do. If it doesn't work out, it's not a big loss, you know. With film, that's a very difficult fish. So the stress on producing something on a film is much higher than for stills. You know? And I like the non-stress on photographs, because you know? I give myself stress enough to make something out of it. I don't need external stress. It's also a difference in that film is an industry. You know? So the industry will try to get your film to be seen. But if you take a photograph, there's no industry. You know, what do you do with the picture? Try to put it in a magazine, put it on website now or internet. It's a different story. You can, if you're lucky, you can get books made. You can have exhibitions, and that way you can show what you made. But other than that, there is no industry to show your pictures.
You said you talked about the difference between photography and films. Your next film, Life, 2015, is about a photographer who did a very famous picture. How did that story came about? It's a photographer who took a famous picture of James Dean, I have to mention.
Yeah, it's the photograph on Times Square where James Dean walks. I don't know. I mean, I was asked to do this film, and then I managed to get Dane DeHaan to play James Dean and Rob Patterson to play the photographer. And I think I like the idea because I photograph, of course, a lot of people who are also in the public eye, as James Dean was. And how do you forge a bond between yourself and your subject matter? You know? And that's what partly the film is about. So I like, that is the element that I liked most about making that film. Yeah, I mean, it was a small budget, and we had to film in Canada instead of America. So the scene of the Times Square, we did in studio. there was a massive studio, all blue screen. It was all built later for the film. And then, because we shot in Canada, it was a really, really cold winter, like minus 20, so it was so hard to shoot. And then the wind chill factors on top of that, so it was minus 28 degrees. I mean, it's not built for that, so it was a difficult film for me to make. And there was a few other reasons I didn't get on with some people. That was the toughest film for me so far. And I just finished the film. Finished shooting a film. It's not finished yet, but we're in editing. And that was actually one of the nicest films for me to make. And we shot in Rome, Northern Italy, Zurich, and England. And it was a delight.
Is it also based on a book?
No, it's based on a stage play called Switzerland. And then the same author wrote it, rewrote the stage play for screenplay. And I think we're going to call it The Talented Miss Highsmith.
What do you think about many of the Patricia Highsmith films? Is there some film you like especially in the past?
Well, I've always liked American Freund, Wim Wenders with Dennis Hopper. Also because I played in Hamburg, and when I did Most Wanted Men, I watched that film again, because it's nice if you film something in a place that's not so well known by the cinema goers. And I think Hamburg, it was not a very well known city in movies. And that's attractive to me, you know, when I see a film that's placed in LA, so you know everything, you know. But with Hamburg, you don't. And I like that about it. I think also, you know, Wim is a great filmmaker, and American Friend was a fantastic film. You know, and I like that. And, that's with Alain Delon, and it has a French title, that film, La Lune something.
There's also, I think last year or the year before, I think last year was a TV show, a series called Ripley. Have you seen it?
Yes, I saw that, yeah, with Andrew Scott playing the Ripley character. Yeah, I mean, it looked great. Personally, I think Andrew Scott is a great actor, but I don't feel in that film he had the warmth that the character needs. You know, for people to do things for you, you know, your character needs to be more liked, I think.
Did you respond to the black and white photography of this show? Because it looks almost like pictures, pictures, pictures. The story is drawn out over many episodes. But
8 hours. Talent Mr. Ripley spread out of 8 hours. Yeah, but they took their time for sure, yeah. I like the version with Jude Law and...
Matt Damon.
Matt Damon, yeah. And Philip Seymour Hoffman, yeah. Yeah, that's my favorite version, I think.
It's sad that my colleague Pia Reiser is not here, because she's like on our station the biggest Patricia Highsmith fan. She would have a lot of questions about her. But what makes her so fascinating for you?
The film is not, it's a fictional story. So it's not a biopic of Patricia Highsmith. But she was a really good writer, and she was controversial, which is always good, you know. I used to turn down a biopic, but yeah, a kind of bio of somebody whose work I admire, but who had a very nice life. You know, there was no drama in his life or in his work. And I feel I couldn't make a documentary about that, because you need the drama, you know. It's always better. And I think Helen Mirren plays Patricia Highsmith, and she does an amazing job. So it was a delight to work on, yeah.
You have made a documentary which has a lot of drama in it. Can you tell us a little bit about it, the Hypnosis Team?
Yeah, the Square in the Circle. The era that I grew up, you couldn't escape Hypnosis. So many record sleeves were done by them. And there's a lot of talk about, and they published books every year about the record sleeve. So they were a force to be reckoned with. And one of them died, and then the other asked me to make a documentary about them, and I was very reluctant about that, because I felt it's another music-related film, and I don't want to be just pigeonholed. So, but then I met them, and he had so many great stories. And of course, I liked Sleeves. I love Sleeves, you know, record Sleeves. So the combination of the stories he had and the Sleeves they made me decide to do this documentary. And it was during COVID time, so not a lot of movies were happening. So it felt like a great way to keep working.
It's interesting because like back in the 70s or maybe more in the 80s, there have been different fractions, like the punks against the post-punks, the post-punks and punks against the dinosaur bands before everyone was against everyone, which is not existing today, I think, with young bands. Like a little war going on all the time, but going to this exhibition, seeing your pictures, and even watching a documentary like Squaring the Circle, it was not like this at all, because like Peter Christopherson from Throbbing Gristle was a part of this designer team, and he was from a completely different side of things. Yeah. When you look back at your youth and at this very, very important times of music, do you see it today from the view of today? Because we have now TikTok and this and that. It's such a different view on music without nostalgia. But how do you view it?
I just don't view it at all. I don't feel I'm aware of what happens at the moment, you know, how people get to listen to music. I guess TikTok I've never used. I'm not influenced by that at all. Obviously, Spotify, we all, I guess, have a subscription on Spotify. It is a rip-off. The money should go to the artist. But that's one way to listen sometimes to music, to new music. But the problem with the internet and digital is that music, it lost the value. You know, in the old days, you had to work to get money to buy a record, and you would go to the record store and really make a choice based on either the sleeve or what people had told about you, about the music, or you listened to it in the record store and then you decided to buy it. And then it meant a lot because you had to pay for it and you have it physically in your hands. Now it's just throwaway, you know, you don't pay nothing for it and you can get it anytime you want. And that lost a value because of that. I think if you work for things, it has a value. If you don't work for things, it usually does not have much value.
Maybe one of the best scenes in films about the thing you just said is the beginning of Control, when Ian Curtis buys a record of David Bowie, I can remember, and he goes home and listens to it. That's such a great scene because everything you said, just it's a description of it.
Yes, totally. Yeah, the beginning of Control, that's very relatable for me. You know, you buy a record and you go home and you put it on. And there's also in the documentary, Noel Gallagher is in the documentary, he talks about, oh, you bought a new record by the Smiths or by Mara, whatever, and you took the bus home, and on the bus you already started to read all the liner notes, and they informed you about the record already, and you got home and you read through everything while you played the record. You know, it's like a ritual almost.
Do you think this ritual is coming back in a different way, or is it completely gone?
I think there's what I gather, there's parts of the younger generation that likes the old ways, and they like vinyl again, and they then research back to where this or that, who's influenced by this, and go back and back, and they end probably on the blues. But that's a minority, I guess. Vinyl sales are up every year at the moment. So that's good. They didn't throw, the baby out of the bathwater.
We have some film-specific questions on our podcast here. Sometimes we ask them, our guests, is there a film maybe you saw sometimes in life which sparked a love for a certain genre? You talked about Westerns before. Has it been Westerns, or what's your favorite genre maybe within movies?
I like Westerns. I like dark comedy. You know, the Coen brothers are sometimes good for that, or the Fargo or something. I sometimes like rom-coms. I don't like horror at all. Very scary movies. I like spy movies.
Do you follow cinema in general, or just maybe some film here or there? What's your view of cinema?
I love watching a movie in a cinema, but because of my chaotic lifestyle, I very, very little go into cinema. I watch two little movies I have to watch for the BAFTAs. I have to watch movies at the end of the year. And I'm very grateful for that. But I don't watch all the films, all the, you know, to the end, because it's just too much. I also like movies that I use images. I think Tarkovsky I always liked, you know, because images are not logically follow up on each other, and they are just very strong. Every image is a strong story in a way. There's another Polish director who made Cold War.
It's interesting because you mentioned Tarkovsky. When I thought about The American, when I, before this podcast, I viewed some of the films again, and I thought, when has George Clooney played maybe a similar role, a little bit melancholic, like this part? And there's a remake of a Tarkovsky film, Solaris, by Steven Soderbergh, and it's the same kind of Clooney, yeah, like a moody Clooney in a way.
I've not seen it, but I know about it, yeah. Soderbergh is also quite a good filmmaker, I think.
Have you ever seen a film that was good, but you won't watch it a second time because it was disturbing?
I draw a blank.
Or have you seen a film where you have been too young to see it? You said your parents just didn't watch your films as a child, but was there a film you thought, like, as a teenager, and you thought, oh, wow, this was for grown-ups and not for me?
Well, in Holland, there would be movies that have some sexual content in it, you know. Like, there was a movie called...
Maybe a Paul Verhoeven film, maybe a Paul Verhoeven picture.
Yes, this was, and it was watched by so many people. It was the most sold tickets in Holland, I think, for a movie. Turkish Delight, but Turk's Fruit, yeah.
Oh, yeah. You've seen it too young.
Yeah, I think, you know, everybody wanted to see that. When you're young, it's like, oh, yeah, there's some sex in it or something. It's exciting.
Which films make you happy? Is there a certain film you want to watch it again and again because it gives you a good mood in a way?
No, I have not prepared any answer for these questions. So a lot of there are, of course, movies I want to see again and again. And, you know, Chinatown, for instance. I love Chinatown. Quite a few movies with Jack Nicholson in it. Yeah, I have to come back to that question, I think.
No problem. You mentioned Chinatown. It's such a masterpiece, but without talking anything about the director Polanski, but just the film itself, do you think a film like this could be made today? Or is it a film that's so 70s New Hollywood?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think it's the latter. I mean, even The American, you could get made today. I think impossible, you know. It's 270s in its appeal. Because nowadays people want faster movies. They want, they don't want to have to think too much, I think. I mean, talking generally about the bigger movies. I mean, the trailer they did for The American, in which I had no say, was showing it like an action film. So it went to number one in America, which was, of course, amazing for me. Well, your second film goes to number one in America. But it was for about a week because the word of mouth was so negative because all the people who went to see it expected an action movie. And the people who would have liked the film were put off by the trailer, so they didn't go. And it was only till it came out on DVD a year later or so that it gained some audience. I mean, Patti Smith really liked the film. And she told me that she was once with George Clooney in a room together and they started talking. And she said that she really liked The American. And he said, well, don't you think it's a little, anyway, it's like hard to get into or something. And she said, yeah, well, not for me. I watched it 5 times. So that was great. So some people really love that film because it's so different, you know, that, and that's what I mean. You can't make it nowadays anymore, these films. But it's so great it exists.
Yeah, it seems on the one hand, we have this big blockbusters and big studio films. And on the other hand, we have... still very exciting films that you can only see at film festivals. Yeah. But the small drama-orientated movie seems to be like only on streaming anymore, but not in cinemas.
Yeah, it's fucked up. Yeah. I mean, there's so much to see and so little that's really satisfying. At least is what I see.
You worked with a lot of stars, Robert Pattinson, George Clooney. A director once said to me, an Austrian director who made a film in Hollywood, said, those films are only possible because of the actors. The actors are like, in the old times, in the medieval times, like the church, they make the films possible. Is this true?
Apparently, yeah. Yeah. I think less so now, maybe. But, you know, it's like for Control, it really started to take off when Samantha Morton signed on, because she was Oscar-nominated actress. Of course, George Clooney for The American, that was a no-brainer. Philip Seymour Hoffman also was very good for Most Wanted Man. And Rob Patterson and Dane DeHaan together, I think, helped making life possible. But my budgets have gone down every film. You know, well, apart from Control. Control was only like 2,500 or something. 2.5 million. And The American was something like 18 million or so, maybe 20 at most. Most Wanted Man was probably 17. Live is probably 15. And the last film is probably about 17 again. Yeah, I mean, I'm not a producer on these films, so I don't know the real amounts, but just to show you the sort of ballpark figure that I work in, these films are hard to get made these days. If you do a blockbuster, you know, people think that if you spend 80 million on a film, it probably comes back with twice that amount. And a film for 70 million might be lucky to make 20 million. So, you know, the return is very small for them.
Robert Pattinson is an interesting figure because he started with these blockbusters and big teenager films, but for many years he's kind of a muse to art house directors, Claire Denis, different people.
Robert makes interesting choices. He's a lovely guy and really much better actor than people give him credit for. Him. Very understated kind of acting.
Are you watching any remakes, or is there any remake that comes to mind that's better than the original, or is the original always the best?
Oh, that's hard. I can't think of any remakes at the moment. Can you mention a few?
There are so many. I mean, reboots and remakes and sequels and prequels. It seems original movies are so rare these days.
Yeah, that's kind of true. You know, once you have an audience for a movie, why not get into the cinema again by making a part two? Yeah.
Just a question. Is there a certain song you would use, would love to see in movies? Or how do you view the interaction between soundtracks, songs in movies? Because you also have so much music experience. How do you view music in films? You did Control.
Yeah. Well, Control, I think, had a great soundtrack. You know, I was very involved in that. Because there were existing songs, apart from some newer stuff which put in the studio together. But the first three movies I made, I put a Dutch song in every single one of them to thank, you know, this Dutch band that when I listened to the transistor radio at night in my room, that I felt somehow gave me hope that, you know, maybe my photography would become something at some point. So there was Super Sister, QB and the Blizzards, and a band called Brainbox. And after that, I stopped doing that. But so I was involved in that way. Now, the soundtrack now is called, it's done by Dickon. What's that fucking? He was in a band called Tindersticks, and he's making the soundtrack for this movie. Yeah, you know, it's really amazing how sound and vision work so well together. And I've always loved films that had a particular artist doing all the music. Like there's a film full of Cat Stevens songs. It's the one with the Maud and some, you know, the old woman and the young boy that's fascinated by cemeteries and death. Harold and Maud.
Harold and Maud, okay.
Yeah, it's all Cat Stevens songs. And then you have Amy Mann, songs in a movie by
Philip Seymour Hoffman by Paul Thomas Anderson, Magnolia.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, so I like that you have one artist doing all the songs for a film. There's not that many of those. There's the Zombies. They did a movie. They did. They were in a Danish film that Lars von Trier wrote, and one of the Dogma directors directed and only at the zombies on.
My very last question is, what's your favorite part of filmmaking? Because you're now in the editing room, but what is the favorite part?
I have to say the shooting, because you have to be on top of your toes, and every day is challenging, and it's so interesting. You're really making something, you know. And you're working together with the actors. So it's the stage where you're the most creative. Of course, now with editing, we found something in the editing that makes the film quite different, and it was really interesting. But it's a lazier part of filmmakers. You sit in a chair and you're having your coffee and you're having this and that. And of course, the preparation, that can be years, you know. It's exciting in bits and pieces, but not as much as the shooting itself.
Thank you very much for your patience and to be a part of the FM4 Film Podcast. Thanks a lot, and have all the best for your new film.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Der FM4 Film Podcast. Jeden Montag Mitternacht auf FM4 und überall, wo es Podcasts gibt.
The dawning of Allah. Servus, wir sind's, Calm und Crooked. Und wir haben's schon immer gewusst.
Das Land ist einfach voller guter Electronic Artists.
Die Red Bull Symphonic Masterclass.
Mit Calm und Crooked und Christian Kolonowitz. Yeah.
Lauter nice Electronic Classic Crossover Hits sind dabei entstanden.
Und die hört's exklusiv
bei der FM4 House Party.
Mit allen Tracks der Masterclass.
Am 13. Juni um 21 Uhr in Laboon Deluxe.
Hey, das wird die Uraufführung.
Die FM4 House Party. Presented by Red Bull Symphonic Masterclass. FM4.
I don't believe in an interventionist God. But I know, darling, that you do. But if I did, I would kneel down and ask him. Not to intervene when it came to you. Well, not to touch a hair in your head, leave you as you are. If he felt he had to direct you, then direct you into my arms. Into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms. Oh Lord, into my arms. Oh Lord, into my arms. And I don't believe in the existence of angels. Looking at you, I wonder if that's true. But if I did, I would summon them together. And ask them to watch over you. Well, to each burn a candle for you, to make bright and clear your path, and to walk like Christ in grace and love, and guide you into my arms. Into my arms, oh Lord. Into my arms, oh Lord. Into my arms, oh Lord. Into my arms. I believe in love, and I know that you do too. And I believe in some kind of path. The weekend walk down me and you. So keep your candles burning, make a journey bright and pure, that you'll keep returning always and evermore. Into my arms, oh Lord. Into my arms, oh Lord. Into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms.
Jojo on FM4 Sleepless.
Yes, yes, it's time to get it started. Let's get this sleepless thing rolling. Here's Camo and Crooked with this one called All Night.
Sind unterwegs seit Tag 1.
blood, your skin in your blood, your chicken in your cow, wow, wow. Looking dangerous, I'm looking at your eye. I'm impatient, I'm a patient, and I pinch you all in blood. Entertainment, no taming, I'ma spit you all like blood. You don't get me, I'm a wow, 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 wow. If I fall behind, can I get a cushion in my lazy eye? Look in all directions, but I never find nothing worth a mention. Looking dangerous, I'm looking at ya. I'm impatient, I'm a patient, and I paint you all in black. Entertainment, ain't no taming, I'ma spit you all like black. You don't get me, I'm all wild, 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 wild. Straight to hell, see if I give a f-
hey. You're not my fucking problem. Nogueres with Not My Problem, one of my favorite expressions. Before that, Verifiziert featuring Prodzuki with Unterwegs. And even before that, starting off the sleepless adventure, Camo and Crooked with All Night. And we're going to be doing our thing during the night with Camo and Crooked. Coming up on the 20th of June, Donauinsel Fest at the FM4 Bühne. It's going to be out of control. And hosted by me, your man, DJ JoJo. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Sleepless. It's your man, DJ JoJo, behind the mic. The